This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
I don't know exactly what the Satan is, what Satan is, but he's a mischief maker. Look what he did.
Who are we talking about, Rabbi?
The Satan. You wouldn't know anything about him, yeah. For us ordinary mortals, you know, you've never come across him. Kesheba Avraham Mehar HaMoriah, when Avraham came down from Har HaMoriah, from the mountain where he nearly sacrificed Yitzchak.
Where are
we, Rabbi? In the Pirkei Rav Eliezer, and that same bit of background, but we'll come back to the Chumash very shortly, so don't say. When Avram came down from Har HaMoriah, Hara Apo Shel Satan, the Satan was really furious. Shira'o Shelo also, Biyodo Tavas Liboy Levachel Korbono Shel Avraham. He wanted to deny Avraham the opportunity of demonstrating his faithfulness. So the way he did that, Biyodo, welcome. The way he did that was, or the way he tried to do that, was first by getting Avraham not to go. So we didn't get into that because it wasn't part of our subject matter, but some of you might know that medrash where the Satan appeared as a fire and as a river and tried to distract Avraham so that he wouldn't go to this mountain. Eventually, when he came, when Avraham plows through it all, the Satan whispers to Avraham, and here one understands what the Satan is. The Satan here is Avraham negotiating with himself, debating with himself, and the Satan says, surely you realize that God would never ask you to do such a thing. So surely you realize that there's a ram up on that mountain, and when you get there, you won't be asked to sacrifice Isaac. So as to take away the sense of sacrifice, as to take away the sense of dedication. And Abraham's reply to the Satan was, you've tricked me so many times before, I can't believe you on this either. In other words, this is one thing where the process of rationale, I can't follow. It is so clear to me that this is what I have to do. And yes, it is absurd to me too. But I can't get involved in that absurdity because that would lead me to question something which I know is for absolute sure is desired. And really that little debate that Abraham has with himself relates right back to Judy's first question, which set us off on this whole discussion, which is, what do you do with a mitzvah that's giving you nothing? It's just not really doing anything for you. It's asking a lot of you and not really doing anything for you. And the archetype of that mitzvah would be what? What would be the mitzvah that does that fits into that category most of all?
We're talking about the shadow?
No, not necessarily.
Sacrificing your own child.
Yes, there's none more than this. A mitzvah that gives you nothing. What can it take? What can it possibly give you? Sacrificing your own son. And that's why I use that as the model for the answer to Judy's question. The first requirement is that you're absolutely sure that that's what God wants of you, and that's the whole thing. How do you get that sure enough? Abraham was relatively easy. God told him. But God doesn't tell me things very frequently. I don't know about you. He might tell some of you things. Mrs. Condy doesn't.
No.
you once told me that he told you something.
No, I usually don't know.
I thought that you get direct communication. I don't, and that makes it very difficult to know what God wants of you. But we have ways of working out in many situations, not always, but in many situations, fairly clearly. Now, what about just saying the halakha? Is the halakha what God wants of you? If you know that this is the din, does that mean that that's what God wants of you?
I think it does.
Why not?
Maybe just if you had taken on at that time, it was your potential to take on the future.
So if you're in a growth phase, that could be an issue. See, what's important is the difference between a din and halakha, if we were to differentiate those.
Is it the same as the difference between a guideline and a rule? But the din is a rule. That's it. There's no wiggle room. Whereas halacha is like a path that you walk down, and there's.
Well, fortunately, very fortunately, Judaism is the only religion where there are no rules that have no wiggle room. There isn't one, and if there is one, it's probably only the law of Kiddush Hashem, that which has quite wide ramifications, but in its narrowest sense, is if you're asked to publicly deny your religion and adopt another religion, you'd rather give your life. That's about the only law that doesn't have wiggle room. Everything else does, and that's what is probably the greatest aspect of our religion, is that the model doesn't have wiggle room. Okay, remember we talked about the Torah as a model, as a perfect model, but halakha is the bridging of the model to reality, to the real life in which we operate, which is a world that we have molded over time, starting with Adam's mistake. So from the time that Adam did what God told him not to, that had impact on causing the world to diverge further and further away from the model. So now you've got a model of perfection, and you've got an imperfect world. There's no way you can just take the model and impose it on the imperfect world. That doesn't make the world perfect. That's the most mature aspect of our religion, and different to any other religion. That there's a very clear understanding that simply taking the model and imposing it doesn't make this world pure. That's why we haven't built a temple. It was very fascinating. I asked Rabbi Dembo of Esha Torah in Santa Monica how he got involved originally when he became religious. And it's a long story, but part of it was really, really fascinating. He knew nothing about anything Jewish at all, other than that he was Jewish. And he found a Bible. And he read the Bible. And he decided, this makes eminent sense. This book is real. This is real, true stuff. He had a very good friend. He said, what do you think of this book? Let's read it. They read it from cover to cover. He said, this is real. Why did nobody teach this to us? Well, they couldn't figure that out, but what really intrigued them is why they're the only ones to know about it. Because if it's real, where's the temple? Where are the sacrifices? Why isn't everybody in Jerusalem? The Jews don't know anything about the Bible, and they set themselves up to go and tell everybody about the Bible, and that brought them into engaging with Esha Torah and everything that followed from it. But we don't have a Beit HaMikdash. We don't have a temple. We haven't rebuilt the temple. We don't bring sacrifices. Why not? It says in the Torah we should. Why don't we have those things? Why don't we have a Sanhedrin? Why are there so many things the Torah tells us to do that we're not doing today? The reason is because we understand fully well that you cannot take the model and impose it on an imperfect society. Society is not ready yet for a life with the temple. Society is not yet ready yet for a life with Mashiach. We would never survive a life with Mashiach. We wouldn't be able to cope with it. We wouldn't be able to handle it yet. That's something we've got to work ourselves around to. And it's that gap between an imperfect world and a perfect system that creates halakha. A din is a stated law, and that's why you come to Lisa saying it's a rule. In essence, yes, but we don't ever use that word, a din. It's a fairly modern word. It's a din. It's halakha. What is it? And it's not a halakha. It's halakha. What does halakha mean? Halakha means, what does it mean?
Halakha.
To walk, the way you go. It's an approach. It's a way of walking. It's a natural integration of life and the Torah and everything. That's what halakha is. Which means that in different people's situation, things are different. So, what is the din? Is one allowed to eat pork? No. That's the din. What is the halakha? Yeah, there are certain circumstances where you can eat pork if there's nothing else available, and you might die if you don't eat it. So now you start with the wriggle room. So even a law like that, Jews don't eat pork, have wriggle room. Do you have to keep the Shabbat? Yes. Are there situations where you don't keep the Shabbat? Sure, there's situations where you don't keep the Shabbat. Now, where that grey area is, or that wriggle room is a nice word, is what the area of halakha is, and that differs from circumstance to circumstance. No two people have the same circumstance. And that's how you create a shaila. That's what a shaila is. A shaila is not, Rabbi, may I turn the light on Shabbat? The answer is no. A shaila is, Rabbi, I know that one may not turn the light on Shabbat. For certain reasons, I'm asking whether I need to abide by that law in this situation too. Well, that's a different situation. Let's see, what is the situation? What's the thing? Where are you? What's the situation? And one analyzes. That's halakha. So when we talk about knowing that God wants something of you, that's not knowing that is the halakha. Knowing that God wants something from you is knowing what the halakha is for you at that time, at that circumstance. That's what's critical. So should a Jewish married woman cover her hair? Yes, that's the halakha. should I, Mr. So-and-so, be covering my head at this particular point in my life and in the society in which I operate and the environment in which I am? That's the shayla, that's the question. And so it is with virtually every halakha that there is. So what then becomes the key ingredient to determining whether it's God's will or it isn't? How do you now know what the halakha is for you in a given situation?
So now
becomes a shayla. It becomes a shayla. And then what becomes the key ingredient? The rabbi, the person to whom you ask the shayla, what are his competencies? What do his competencies need to be? Competencies need to be.
He has to know the person.
Number one, he has to know the halakha. He has to know the Torah, number one. Number two, he has to know the person and their situation. And number three, he mustn't be dogmatic. If he's a dogmatic person, he's not for that role. He can be a teacher, he can teach people what the halakha is. A dogmatic person can make a good teacher in certain areas, but he cannot be a decider of halakha in a given person's situation. In halakha, we have a term which is often misused, and that's we talk about our poskim. Poskim are people who make halakhic decisions for the generation. So when a halakhic issue comes up for the generation that isn't covered by a bland statement somewhere, so must you keep Shabbat? Sure, you must keep Shabbat. You don't need a posek for that. But is a microwave telephony, does that constitute breaking the Shabbat? There's no spark, there's no light, there's no work, there's no this. Is that or isn't that? That's a question for a person. Now that's going to affect, that's not one person coming on and saying, may I use a cell phone? That is the generation saying, we have a new situation, not governed by previous halakhic decision. What does the generation do about that? That needs the posek. So the posek is a person who individualizes halakha for the generation, not for one individual. A rabbi, a rav, individualizes the halakha for one individual. A posek individualizes the halakha for an issue facing the generation. And we divide our poskim wrongly into what we call machmirim and mekilim. Machmirim are ones who take a tough line, and the mekilim are the ones who take the lighter line. And one of the greatest known mekilim, and I say that in quotation marks, was Reb Moshe Feinstein, who died about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, a little longer. And I asked him why that is so. Why does he get that name? And he answered me so beautifully. He said most poskim, when they get a shayla, it is an intellectual question. It tests their intellectual prowess, their knowledge of Torah. He said, when I get a shayla, I'm not being questioned about Torah. I'm being given a human problem. There's a human being at the other end of that shayla. There's a person who knows what the halakha is but has a major problem with it. And my job is to try and solve their problem within halakha. And so I will find whatever way I can to solve the problem. Sometimes solving the problem is studying it through with them in a way that they get a greater understanding of it, and they don't have the problem anymore when they have a greater understanding of it. And sometimes solving the problem is finding a way out for them, and sometimes you cannot solve the problem. It just is a problem, and there is no way out, and that's a human tragedy. And he deals with it like a human tragedy. He doesn't deal with it callously. So it's not a question of machmir or mekel. The question is the rabbi or the posek, does he view a shayla as a human problem or as an intellectual problem? And keep away from the ones who view them as intellectual problems. And keep away from the ones who view their rabbinics as a power tool. Those are all the traps that one falls into. It becomes a power tool, and he decides what you do. And he's not there to decide, he's there to teach. So all he can do is teach you the parameters, give you the basis, try and find roots for you, give you an appreciation of it, and at the end of the day, it's your decision that you have to take. So in determining, in back to Judy's question, the first thing is this what God wants from me now? That requires, you know what the law is, you have a situation that you think maybe requires the law to be modified in your particular case at this particular time. It may not last forever, but right now it is. You find a rabbi who knows the law, who knows you, who is flexible and not dogmatic, and views a shayla as a human problem. You discuss it with him, and you find a solution. And part of that process should be greater appreciation of it, and the outcome of that should either be relief or finding value in that law. Part of passing a shayla for a person sometimes is giving them a sense of value and understanding of what it is. If there isn't a way out for them, if it's something that they ought to be doing, then it requires giving them a sense of appreciation. Now, going that route avoids the temptation to simply abandon anything that's stretching you. Because that's the problem with your question. If one were to say, well, no, if it's giving you nothing, don't do it. The problem with that is you never stretch. Stretch always goes through a process of at first it's hard and it's unrewarding. When you sit down and study a piece of Gemara for the first time, when you sit down and you do your musical scales, when you sit down and learn your Latin declensions, whatever it is that you study, the first part for hours and hours or days and days or weeks and weeks and sometimes months and months, it's not pleasant. It's not nice and it's not inspirational. You can try and give a bit of a taste and a bit of a feeling for it, but at the end of the day, it's just slugging. But you need to go through that to get to the next point, that stretch. So to say to somebody, if it's causing you difficulty, don't do it yet. Wait until you're ready for it. You'll never be ready for it. So bringing the rabbi into the discussion brings an objective source that can help you. That's like your coach, who says you can do another press-up or another pull-up, and you can do another five, and you're not stopping now. And if you take a rest, you're going to do another 10. And you do. You manage it. And would you have managed it without him? No. You would have been convinced that there was no way you could do another five. In fact, you did the other five. And that's really the role that the rabbi should have, is to be able to guide you accurately as to when you can do the next five and when you shouldn't be doing the next five. Because you're going to pull a muscle, and that means you won't come to gym for another 3 weeks, and then you're going to be back worse than you were weeks before that, and that's been counterproductive. That's what the rabbi's role is. Does that help answer the question? Anyway, back to the Satan. So having not been able to distract Abraham, Ma'asa, what do you do? He never gives up, this guy. So he starts tackling Sarah, and he goes to Sarah and he says, hey Sarah, Lo shamat mashanase bo'ilam, have you been keeping up with the news? Do you know what's been happening in the world? I'm real alive. She says, no, quite frankly, we don't keep a television at home, and I haven't been listening to the radio. Oh my God, you haven't heard it. It's all about your husband. You know what he did. Lokach ishech hazoke l'nai l'yitzchak, that old man, Sinan, he took the child, the young boy, young man, and he sacrificed him. Didn't you hear about that? V'hanar boche, the child was crying. U'miyalil, he was wailing. Shelo yochali yinatzo, nothing could save him. Miyad itchila boche u'miyalil, as she began to cry and to wail. Bachta shalosh b'chiyos k'neged shalosh tekiyos. She cried three cries like the tekiyah that we blow on Rosh Hashanah. Shalosh yilolos k'neged shalosh yevovos. She cried three like the shvorim truer that we blow on Yom Rosh Hashanah, and she died. So she didn't succeed in causing Avraham not to bring the sacrifice. At least he would try and make him regret it and question it. So he didn't question it before. Now he'll come down from the mountain. At least he's going to say to himself, what kind of a God is this? And then the Satan has scored a point, which gives us some kind of understanding of how the Satan works. Now, of course, again, the Satan is in each of us, so this is something that happened in Sora. So what must have happened? Sora must have heard the news. Somebody must have said something to her, and this must have gone through her mind, and she must have thought, has my husband gone off his mind? How, God would never do such a thing. That's not possible. What did he do? She hasn't got anybody to ask or anything, and she dies of shock.
I thought she died because Yitzhak cried.
Yeah, but that's Sotan says, Yitzhak cried. But she hears that
The whole tragedy,
the fact that Avram did it, the fact that Yitzhak cried, the fact that Avram couldn't overcome it, that Yitzhak couldn't overcome him, and that she lost Yitzhak, all of it together was just a massive tragedy of a senile old man destroying everything they spent their life building up. And she just saw no future, she saw nothing. Yitzhak gone, Avram's senile. All of this has been a big joke. There's no God then, maybe. There's no... What is it all about? What's happened? Everything they've done has been destroyed. Now she's an old woman with a senile husband and no child. So she dies out of total desperation. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Is there a connection between the idea that she cried like a tekiah and like a shivarim, the way that when you sound a ram's horn, that her crying was like the sound of the ram's horn? Is there a link between that and the ram on the mountain?
Yes, absolutely.
And sacrifice, so that it's almost as if she died. I mean, someone died in the process.
Mm. Yeah, and probably at the same moment.
And so maybe, was it like her death? What's the connection?
The connection probably is, and it's all happened on Rosh Hashanah, which is why we read about this on Rosh Hashanah, with blowing of the shofar. It's all connected, and probably it is the innate tragedy of knowing part of the story in Jewish life. Of seeing part of the story. If you don't see it, as I spoke about, and the night on Monday night, I'm sure. If you don't see the full story from beginning to end, your picture has to be distorted. How do you cope with that distortion? And distortion creates tragedy. If you don't see it till the end, you know, take any fairy tale, and if you don't get to them, they live happily ever after. It's terribly distraught. If you tell a child one of these stories and stop before you get them, they live happily ever after, and you have nightmares. Life is tragic when you don't see the full perspective, and we seldom see the full perspective, and Sarah didn't see the full perspective. She saw a piece of it. She didn't see Yitzhak coming back alive and the whole story and why it happened. She didn't get that far, and if you don't get that far, there's tragedy, there's crying, and that's part of the shofar and of the ram. One has to be able to see a thing through to its ultimate end before one can get a complete picture.
Is it humanly possible to see things through to the ultimate end, or is that something that only comes in
Firstly, it is humanly possible to know that you haven't seen it through to the ultimate end yourself. And number two, not to think that I've seen it through to the ultimate end, and therefore, where is God? It's at the end of the story. Hang on, we're not finished the story yet. Don't be so impatient. So that's humanly possible. And secondly, it's sometimes humanly possible to do it by looking at the model. You can't look at it by looking at the real world, but by looking at the model, it becomes a little, and that's one of the reasons we study the model, because the model is the whole of reality. So in the model, we can understand some of purpose and some of intent, and then you're going to Kabbalah and all these things. There you can start getting some idea of what it's all about and where it might be leading. But if you're just studying a small time frame of life and a small area of life, then you're not going to get it, and there's going to be a part missing, and that is tragedy. And then people make decisions based on their small time frame viewpoint. And that's where the tragedy comes in, and that's part of the idea of Rosh Hashanah. Yeah.
Seemingly, Sarah moved from a position of faith to a position of no faith. And she was someone who had direct contact with God. She was a prophetess. So how are we, as just like normal people who don't have contact with God, how must we keep faith?
I think that's part of the Kal Vachomer process, that when we get up to God and God says, why did you lose faith? Every one of us has the opportunity to say, you know what? Even Sarah did for a moment and lost her life for it. There's just a limit to how much a human being can take of absurdity. Mm-hmm. And it's not ideal. I'm sorry I lost faith. I wish I didn't lose faith. But I did, and so did Sarah. So if the best of us have done it, it's going to be a human pain. Because we are seeing short parts of it, we try not to. We try and recover it. We try and keep it. But there are moments when we do get desperate, and that's normal. And that gives us an argument to God, so to say, that this is normal. This is the way you've made us. And yes, we need to cope with that, and we need to try and overcome that, but it's a reality. We're going to lose faith every now and again, as a nation and as an individual.
Can we assume that if Abraham had come home with his son, that he would have revealed to Sarah the test that he had just come through? And if he had, what would that have done to Sarah?
An interesting speculation. Would he have told her? Would he have just have said, hi, just being out for the morning? And
well, this couldn't be something that, I mean, for me, this would have been coming through a tremendous test on not being sure that I should have accepted the test to begin with. And I don't know that this is something that I could share so easily with my spouse, that I made a decision
to sacrifice
our child. I mean, I would have found that extremely difficult.
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know what he would have done, whether he would have shared it with her or not. Or just have said, we went up the mountain, wonderful place, a special place, and we brought a sacrifice there, and come down.
No.
Of course, the problem was that Yitzhak came back blind.
He did?
From the angels crying, and from his father's crying, tears, angels' tears, and Avram's tears fell into his eyes. We'll come to that. Yes, so he might have had to explain that. So somehow that might have been a little difficult. But I don't know how he would have handled that with Sarah. And maybe he couldn't have. Maybe there's no way he could have handled it with Sarah.
To what? I mean, everyone suffered because of this. It just seemed like such a futile... I mean, why would God, a just God, want to play such a trick? I mean, it makes me so sick.
Because
these are rushed people. Sarah died.
Is it a trick? Isaac
got
blind. You'll do this for me.
It
and
is.
Why did he need this test to prove that?
It's not just a test. It's an establishment. It's an establishment at the foundation of our nation, that the foundation of on which we're structured would do anything, and this is the basis that we get through. This is why the Jewish people are still here. If it weren't for this, there would not be no Jewish nation today. This is the foundation on which. Absolutely. That's why we. That's why we start three times a day. How do we start out Shmoneh Esrei? God of Abraham, God of Yitzchak, God of Yaakov. Just remember who Abraham was, and that's where we come from. And if we're not that great, our grandfather was. And you made certain promises to him for the things he did. That's the way we start our appeal. Without that, what basis do we have to appeal to God? What can we even start a debate with God? Well, how can we start a dialogue with him if we don't come from this kind of stock, where these people have given that much? And the Holocaust, was any easier to understand? Was any less suffering? And the people who died there, these are things that however we're going to understand them in their time frame, they gave us the basis to make certain demands and have certain expectations of God. Kelsey and then Linda.
Does Sarah sort of went through a test similar to Abraham's test in Texas State? And he had 3 days to prepare for it, like walking up the mountain, you know, fighting with the sun. And she had it like that. And it seems a little like, you know, if she had 3 days to prepare for it, she might have been able to survive it as well.
Clearly, we have to assume also that this was her time to die in any event. And there's no sense that she died before her time, or that she was an old lady. She was 127 years old.
Abraham
went on still for a while. There's a sense that this was her time in any case. But you're right, that her handling of it... Abraham was also told in one go, take your son and sacrifice, and you could have died.
Yeah, they had 3 days to actually, you know, get there and say, well, I'm actually going to do this,
deal with it. You're right. And I think what we learn from here is the danger of desperate thinking, the danger of confusion, that one can be confronted with a situation that is so confusing, and the first thing one has to do is give oneself time. Let me find out the facts. This can't be. My husband wouldn't have done that. There must be a mistake. And in
like
a sense, she's...
You never, like, completely believe...
Yes, and in her state, you see, if there is any level of punishment, it would be of that, of assuming that her husband did something like that and that God let him go ahead with it. That there was that lack of faith. But yes, you're right, there was a state of such confusion, such desperation, and that the only way she could have dealt with that, and that, if anything, to learn, is exactly that. In 1 second, just hold off, let me just not deal with this yet. There's a whole lot of stuff I need to find out before I even form an emotional response to this. It doesn't sound right. Therefore, I've got to sort it out before I even form an emotional response. We can die from the wrong emotional response. And too often, we get angry without finding out the facts, we get upset, and our minds start going, and in our imagination, we've already created this whole scenario, and it isn't right. Somebody you did expect to call, you didn't expect to call, you somebody was supposed to come, and didn't come, somebody promised to do something, didn't, and now you start building a whole emotional web around that, and you find out that he had a flat tire. And that's all that it was. It was nothing more than that. We have to be careful not to allow ourselves to respond with full emotional power before the thing has unraveled and we have some sense of what really took place. Isn't
it? I was just thinking that in terms of the Torah as a blueprint. I mean, you know, when you say you're going to identify as a Jew, essentially you are saying that you are the one to sacrifice your child. You're going to raise your child as a Jew, and they probably, history has shown that some descendants may along the way say that doesn't do them. Or somebody who doesn't like Jews.
By virtue of being Jew, that being Jewish requires the willingness
to sacrifice.
To, if necessary, go through a Holocaust.
Right. I mean, and it's not just the Holocaust, I mean, yeah, it's all through time. So, again, in terms of the Torah as a template, I mean, there's a sad ring of reality to it.
And if we don't like it, then we do it.
Kind of goes back to Detroit.
I have to say I had a hard time with this whole thing about Sarah, because I did hear a shearer that said that she died because the child cried and she thought he should have gone along with her father.
I've never heard that.
That she would have gone along with this, just like Abraham did.
And she cried because Yitzhak...
And she died because Yitzhak cried. She thought, Yitzhak didn't cry. Yitzhak went along with it. And she was disappointed in Yitzhak. And that she... So that she was disappointed. I mean, that was one of the views. I mean, I hope...
I've never heard that. It's a very nice idea. I've never heard that. Who was that from? It's a nice idea, Karen. I don't see a basis for it. It's somebody's interpretation, and it's a nice one. But is that a reason to die? Maybe yes. Maybe she thought that Yitzchak had abandoned his whole belief in it. It's a nice idea, and maybe there is a basis for it, but not in anything that I've seen. Which leads us, and I just want to get started with this at least, which leads us into the beginning of Chaye Sarah, the next Sedrit. And the next Sedrit starts off with the death of Sarah and links back. The sacrificing of Yitzchak, that Avraham was told, saying, Milcah has also given birth to sons for Nachor your brother. So your brother and sister-in-law have had children. There was Utz, and there was Buz, and there was Kemuel, there was Kesed, Chazor, Pildash, Yidlach, and Besuel. So Besuel is now a nephew of Avraham. Is that right? Yes. Uvetuel Yoladet Rivka. And Betuel had Rivka. That we're told at the end of Vayera. At the beginning of Chaye Sarah, we're told that Sarah died at the age of 127 years. Bringing the Medrash to comment how the birth of Rivka precedes the death of Sarah. There's a new female image, a new female character moving into center stage before the first one moves off stage. And how that often happens in history. So Sarah was the quintessence of the female character, right through many sedras. We've been with her for a long time. She's now moved off. Rivka is about to come in. So Chaye Sarah deals with the death of Sarah and the introduction of Rivka, Abraham sending Eliezer to the well and finding Rivka and all of that, which we're going to learn. In the way it states Sarah's death, this is the way it reads: and the life of Sarah was 100 years and 20 years and 7 years, the years of the life of Sarah. And there are a few things that are interesting about this statement. The emphasis on chaye, on life. The life of Sarah was 100 years and 20 years and 7 years. The years of the life of Sarah. But it wasn't just years, there was life. That she lived a life of 127 years. Each of those years was full of life. And that's given a lot of value to it. But the interesting thing that the Medrash says is this 100 years and 20 years and 7 years is a kind of an equation. And there are two versions as to what that means. The one version is, when she was 100, she was as beautiful as when she was 20. When she was 20, she was innocent, as innocent as when she was 7. And that's quite easy to understand. So this was a woman who retained her childish innocence throughout her life, and the heights of her beauty throughout her life. And the two are connected. There is a connection between beauty and innocence. And innocence doesn't mean naivety. Innocence doesn't mean that she never did anything wrong, and innocence doesn't mean that she was always protected. It just means a lack of guile, that she never became a deceitful person in any way, whatever. But the other version in the Medrash, which is the one that Rashi uses, is that when she was 100, she was as innocent as when she was 20, and when she was 20, she was as beautiful as when she was 7. And some say that's just a mistaken version, but Rashi chooses that version. So what do you think that means? Why would it be that way around? Why would you say a person is as innocent as when they were 20? 20 is not an innocent age, and 7 is not a beautiful age. And it's a cute age, but it's not a beautiful age. 20 is far more beautiful, and 7 is far more innocent. Why would the Medrash say she had the innocence of a 20-year-old and the beauty of a 7-year-old, rather than the other way around? And clearly, the innocence of a 20-year-old is very different to the innocence of a 7-year-old. The innocence of a 7-year-old is somebody who hasn't yet engaged with sin, hasn't yet engaged with temptation, hasn't yet engaged with conflict and with paradox. So at 7, it's very easy to be naive, to be innocent. The innocence that Sarah had at 20 was a particularly fascinating innocence, because she had engaged as a full 20-year-old and a very mature 20-year-old. And she had chosen the correct path through all of those issues that she has, which means the Medrash values not the Christian idea of never having sinned. That's the seven-year-old idea. She had the innocence of a seven-year-old, that childish innocence. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the maturity and conflict that a 20-year-old has been through. And through that, she's been able to navigate a path that has left her, a tzaddik, that has left her a righteous woman. That's the pinnacle of innocence as far as we're concerned. Not that she has never done wrong, but that she has navigated life in a way that has kept her righteous. And the beauty, the beauty is not the beauty of a 20-year-old, but the beauty of a 7-year-old. What's the difference between those two beauties? 7-year-old doesn't wear makeup. That's the difference. When you look at a beautiful 7-year-old, you're looking at the kid, there's nothing else. There's no attempt at all to make herself, to use any artificial means, to be anything that she isn't. And that's what Sarah had, even at 20. There wasn't a need for her to do anything other than be herself. She just had that natural quality of natural beauty that she retained throughout her life. And she was just very fortunate having had that. And those are the qualities that are mentioned at her death, because she kept them right through, even the last day of her life. That didn't get spoiled. That she kept all the way through. She dies in Hebron, and Vayova Avraham Lispoid Lesoro Velipkoso. And Avraham came to give a hesped and to cry for her. What does that mean? What is a hesped? And what does it mean he came to cry for her, as if it's something contrived? A hesped is a kind of a eulogy, but what's the difference between a hesped and a eulogy? What's the purpose of what's the purpose of crying over a death in any case? The person's gone to a better place. What's everybody crying about?
For our loss.
For our sense
for
of
our
loss.
For our loss. They may be in a better place, but we don't have them anymore.
And why is that important for us to feel that loss?
Because if you don't feel the loss, then you never felt the loss. And the love and the loss are...
So that's a personal thing. Why do we have to do it publicly? Why is there public mourning, a public hesped? What is the element there? Why are we communicating that sense of love?
So other people,
if you enlighten the load, and it enables everyone to see that everyone else suffers. It lightens the grieving person's load in some small way, and plus then when our own time comes to be grieving, we can remember that we've seen other people grieve. So yeah. It takes away the some of the. At least you don't have to feel like you're the only person who's ever suffered, since you know that other people suffer. And you can only do that by having public grieving.
Okay. I mean, those are all some of the natural outcomes, but what's really important for the deceased is, when he or she comes upstairs, is that people feel there was a loss. If a person comes there and nobody feels the loss, what does God say?
You wasted your life.
Look, nobody's even noticed you're gone. Nobody's crying. So the process of mourning, of crying, quite apart from all the, you know, people often focus on what a wonderful system is, and it's psychologically so good, all true. It's psychologically very good. It's one of the finest processes of mourning that there is, the finest process of mourning in terms of becoming psychologically, being able to cope psychologically with it. The whole process and all its different aspects and elements. But the most important part of it is that for God to see, or for the person almost rather than God, for the person upstairs to see, for it to become clear that there is a gap. And the bigger the gap, the greater is that person's portion in the world to come. So our mourning, that's why we put so much emphasis on how big a mitzvah it is to go to a funeral, to participate in the mourning process. And numbers are important. If a great person dies, it's important to have a lot of people at the funeral. Why? There needs to be a sense that when this person has died, that this person has had a life of impact. And that gives us some kind of a sense, some kind of a guideline as to how we're meant to be living. That there's got to be, each day, one should have to be able to go through, and at the end of the day, you should say, if I wasn't there today, would it have made a difference, and to how many people? Or how much of a difference to one person? If the answer is massive difference, you're on track. If the answer is, you know what, today, it wouldn't have really made a difference to anybody, then that's a problem. And of course, if the answer is, you know, if I wasn't there today, everybody would have been a lot better off, then that's really a problem. And those are the kind of issues that one has to confront. And Hesped is the same. Our eulogies are not to praise and to make a whole big thing out of it. It's simply to focus and communicate to God, to the deceased, to the community, what the essence of the loss is. That's what the purpose of the Hesped is. Now, what happens if the Hesped is false? If you praise a person in a eulogy for something they didn't have, this person was a saint and a great person and an honest person, well, everybody knows he was a crook, you know.
What if you're not in their real life? You're making an image, you're not really talking about them.
And therefore, what's God's response upstairs to this person?
Who are you?
Why do they have to do this? Why do they have to say things about you that aren't true? Couldn't they dig up anything good about you? Is that what they have to say? So that they get punished for very badly. So to give a hesped,
no,
the deceased gets punished very badly if a hesped is not accurate. So we're very, very careful. That's why it's become a thing that everybody who dies gets a eulogy. It's very dangerous stuff. Better not to have a eulogy at all. Better just for people to feel pain and to feel the emotion of the relationship than to say things in a eulogy that aren't right. And now that the rabbinics has become an industry, of course, if the person was wealthy and the family is wealthy and has given a lot of money to the shul or temple, then that's an extra reason to. And very often they'll come and say and tell you what you're supposed to say about them, about the person. And that's playing a very dangerous game for the deceased person, of course, as well as for the person who's telling the lies, but particularly for the. For the deceased person.
But the deceased doesn't have a role in what they're saying.
But the fact that you had to dig up lies.
But then does that mean that deceased person had power over the people?
No, but had power could have lived a life that you wouldn't have had to tell lies about. Mm-hmm. That's what it's all about. The fact that the only way you can honor them is by describing a life that didn't exist throws into question the quality of the life. But it's nothing to do with the eulogies, and nothing to do with honor. Eulogies have got to do with pinpointing and alerting people to the essence of the loss. This isn't just a personal emotional loss. We have lost a person of quality. We've lost somebody who was impacting, and this is the way they impacted. That's what's important for us to know, for God to know, so to say God knows it. But God needs to hear that expressed and felt by people in order to be able to look at the person and say, look what a hole you've left. That's the beginning of their world to come. When the dead person looks down and sees the hole they've left, that's the beginning of the world to come. When the dead person looks down and hears lies at his eulogy, that's the beginning of his hell. That's the difference that takes place.
What about the new thing that people are doing? There's something bad about the person. I've heard about this.
What?
Yeah, actually there was somebody I'm related to, and my family said that one of the children got up and said how angry he was at his father and the things he's done.
That's not the time to do that, Kelsey.
Why is it important that her innocence persists? What's the intrinsic value of the physical beauty? I mean, that's not something most of us can aspire to for the purpose of. Why is it talked about so much? Why is it important that?
Wrong that we can't aspire to that apart from plastic surgery. There are very few people, and particularly women, who are so ugly that only plastic surgery can make them beautiful. Beauty is such a constellation of qualities, and yes, there's the glossy surface beauty which in this movie is prized.
What is the value of the
having
the physical coloration that you don't need makeup?
The value is it ties into the we do in shul where I spoke about the relationship between the outer energy and the inner energy. It's part of that beauty is not, if beauty is the same as I was talking about clothing, if clothing is disjointed from the inner person, and by clothing I mean the whole outer shell, then clothing and beauty and all of that stuff is the way we project ourselves outward. It's our interface with the world. So we can create image, and what we're talking about is image, whether it's beauty, clothing, makeup, it's all image stuff. Image is what we use to project outwards, and therefore what we use to impact. We have various tools with which to impact. We have communication, we have clothing, physical image, we have actions, we have beauty. These are various things that we use to impact. The degree to which our tools of impact are accurate reflections of our inside is an enormous sense of congruence and blessing. To create an image, it's exactly like we're talking about a hesped, to have a eulogy which bears no resemblance to the person's real life, that's an image without a core. When the Torah talks about the fact that she needed to use no artificial means to present her beauty, and that that's a great blessing, it's the ultimate of congruence between what you saw and what was there. It's just the ultimate of congruence of an image and a core absolutely aligned. That's what's important. It's not just a question of how beautiful she was, it's a question of a complete alignment of that which was outside and that which was inside, that which she was projecting and that which she had within herself. Absolutely, I'm sure she wasn't a perfect Barbie doll, but she had an intrigue and she had a fascination and she had an attractiveness. People wanted to get to know her. That's what beauty means. That's what Jewish beauty means. Classical Greek beauty is it conforms to certain objective criteria of aesthetics.
That's not what's meant.
Jewish beauty is she has a quality that makes people want to get to know her. There's an attractiveness, and that has all sorts of different elements that come together.